Blog Talk Radio.
Always Ascending inspires listeners to live life consciously and intentionally by reaching, growing, learning, climbing, becoming, and achieving all that they are capable of. Always Ascending inspires us all to see our life's experiences, the joys and the challenges, as part of our ascension to becoming better human beings. Always Ascending is about purifying and celebrating our life's journeys and our life's experiences. Welcome to Always Ascending.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Always Ascending. On today's show, we're going to recap the 16 characteristics of self-actualizing people as described and studied by American psychologist Abraham Maslow. The study was conducted in the 50s, and he wrote a book called Personality and Motivation, in which these 16 characteristics are explained and in which the study is explained. During the course of the previous shows here on Always Ascending, we have gone over those 16 characteristics, and in the last episode, we concluded with characteristics 14 and 15, which talked about, characteristics 15 and 16, which talked about the resistance to enculturation into society at large, and 16 was the imperfection of self-actualizing people and their ability to recognize their imperfections and to be okay with them. So today I thought it would be great to recap Maslow's study, the topic of self-actualization and the process of self-actualization, and to sort of do a summary of those 16 characteristics. And to begin that, I want to go to the text and the chapter in the book that Maslow has written called Personality and Motivation, and read something that he has in one of the appendices, which deals with a positive approach to psychology. And I'll just go ahead and read what he says, because I find it to be very, very meaningful, very clear in terms of describing the context in which our society, in which the self-actualizing person is placed in society, not placed as in placed by society, but just the context of being a self-actualizing person and what that means in society and in the world in general. So this is Appendix A. The title of Appendix A is Problems Generated by a Positive Approach to Psychology. And I realize this may be very heady or very academic, especially in terms of the way some of it is written, but I think it is important. It says, under the heading, the first subheading, learning, how do people learn to be wise, mature, kind, to have good taste, to be inventive, to have good characters, to be able to fit themselves to a new situation, to detect the good, to seek the truth, to know the beautiful and the genuine, i.e. intrinsic rather than extrinsic learning. Learning from unique experiences, from tragedy, marriage, having children, success, triumphy, falling in love, being ill, death, etc. Learning from pain, illness, depression, tragedy, failure, old age, death. Much that passes for associative learning is actually canalization. It is intrinsic and required by reality rather than relative, arbitrary, and fortuitous. With self-actualizing people, repetition, contiguity, and arbitrary reward become less and less important. Probably advertising of the usual sort is ineffective with them. They are much less susceptible to arbitrary association, to prestige suggestion, to snob appeals, and to simple, senseless repetition. Perhaps even they have negative effect, i.e., make them less likely to buy rather than more likely. Why does so much of educational psychology concern itself with means, i.e., with grades, degrees, credits, diplomas, rather than with ends, i.e., wisdom, understanding, good judgment, good taste? We do not know enough about the acquisition of emotional attitudes, of tastes, of preferences. The learning of the heart has been neglected. Education in practice too often adapts the child to the convenience of adults by making him or her less a nuisance and a little devil. More positively oriented education concerns itself more with the growth and future self-actualization of the child. What do we know about teaching children to be strong, self-respecting, righteously indignant, resistant to domination and exploitation, to propaganda and blind enculturation, to suggestion and to fashion? We know very little about purposeless, unmotivated learning, i.e., latent learning, learning out of sheer intrinsic interest, etc. And then there's another subheading called perception. Perception is too much the limited study of mistakes, distortion, illusions, and the like. Weathermeyer would have called it the study of psychological blindness. Why not add to it the study of intuition, of subliminal perception, of unconscious and preconscious perception? Would not the study of good taste enter here, of the genuine, of the true, and the beautiful? How about the aesthetic perception? Why do some people perceive beauty and not others? Under this same heading of perception, we may also include the constructive manipulation of reality by hope, dreams, imagination, inventiveness, organizing, and ordering. Unmotivated, disinterested, unselfish perception, appreciation, awe, admiration, choiceless awareness. Plenty of studies of stereotypes, but very little scientific study of fresh, concrete, Bergsonian reality. Free-floating attention to the type that Freud spoke about. What are the factors that make it possible for healthy people to perceive reality more efficiently, to predict the future more accurately, to perceive more easily what people really are like, that make it possible for them to endure or to enjoy the unknown, the unstructured and ambiguous and the mysterious? Why do the wishes and hopes of healthy people have so little power to distort their perception? The healthier people are, the more their capacities are interrelated. This holds also for the sensory modalities that make synesthesia, in principle, a more basic study than the isolated study of separate senses. Not only is this so, but the sensory equipment as a whole is related to the motor aspects of the organism. These interrelations need more study. So also do unitive consciousness, cognition or becognition, illumination, transpersonal and transhuman perceiving, the cognitive aspects of mystic experiences and peak experiences, etc. And then there is another heading in this appendix called emotions. The positive emotions, i.e. happiness, calm, serenity, peace of mind, contentment, acceptance, have not been studied sufficiently. Neither have compassion, pity, charity. fun, joy, play, games, sport are not sufficiently understood. Ecstasy, elation, zest, exhilaration, gaiety, euphoria, well-being, the mystic experience, the conversion experience in politics and religion, the emotions generated by orgasm. The difference between the struggle, conflict, frustration, sadness, anxiety, tension, guilt, shame, etc., of the psychopathological person and of the healthy person. In the healthy person, these are or can be good influences. And he goes on to talk about more about emotions, and this particular appendix breaks down various aspects of the psychology of people in general and highlights distinctions for self-actualizing people. I just wanted to read some of it to give you an idea and the context in terms of his argument for the need to study and have a positive approach to psychology. So now let me begin to recap those 16 characteristics of self-actualizing people as Maslow talks about in his book, The Personality and Motivation. So beginning with characteristic number one of self-actualizing people, Maslow, and let me just get to the right page here, just one second. Maslow says that self-actualizing people have the characteristic, and this is characteristic number one, of being more, having a more efficient perception of reality and more comfortable relations with it, with reality. And he says, the first form in which this capacity was noticed was as an unusual ability to detect the spurious, the fake, and the dishonest in personality, and in general, to judge people correctly and efficiently. In an informal experiment with a group of college students, a clear tendency was discerned for the more secure, the more healthy, to judge their professors more accurately than did the less secure students, i.e. high scores in the SI test. As the study progressed, it slowly became apparent that this efficiency extended to many other areas of life. Indeed, all areas that were observed, this could be seen. In art and music, in things of the intellect, in scientific matters, in politics and public affairs, they seemed as a group to be able to see concealed or confused realities, plural, more swiftly and more correctly than others. Thus, an informal survey indicated that their predictions of the future from whatever facts were in hand at the time seemed to be more often correct because less based upon wish, desire, anxiety, fear, or upon generalized character-determined optimism or pessimism. At first, this was phrased as good taste or good judgment, the implication being relative and not absolute, but for more reasons, parentheses, some to be detailed below, close parentheses, it has become progressively more clear that this had better be called perception, not taste, of something that was absolutely there, reality, not a set of opinions. It is hoped that this conclusion or hypothesis can one day be put to the experimental test. So, again, the first characteristic, more efficient perception of reality and more comfortable relationships with it. And the second characteristic of self-actualizing people is acceptance of self, others, and nature. And in his book, he says, a good many personal qualities that can be perceived on the surface and that seem at first to be various and unconnected may be understood as manifestations or derivatives of a more fundamental single attitude, namely of a relative lack of overriding guilt, of crippling shame, and of extreme or severe anxiety. This is in direct contrast with the neurotic person who in every instance may be described as crippled by guilt and or shame and or anxiety. Even the normal member of our culture feels unnecessarily guilty or ashamed about too many things and has anxiety in too many unnecessary situations. Our healthy individuals, meaning the self-actualizing group of people that he studied, find it possible to accept themselves and their own nature without chagrin or complaint, or for that matter, even without thinking about the matter very much. They can accept their own human nature in the Stoic style with all its shortcomings, with all its discrepancies from the ideal image, without feeling real concern. It would convey the wrong impression to say that they are self-satisfied. What we must say, rather, is that they can take the frailties and sins, weaknesses and evils of human nature in the same unquestioning spirit with which one accepts the characteristics of nature. One does not complain about water because it is wet, or about rocks because they are hard, or about trees because they are green. As the child looks out upon the earth with wide, uncritical, undemanding, innocent eyes, simply noting and observing what is the case without either arguing the matter or demanding that it be otherwise, so does the self-actualizing person tend to look upon human nature in himself or herself and in others. This is, of course, not the same as resignation in the Eastern sense, but resignation, too, can be observed in our subjects, especially in the face of illness and death. Be it observed that this amounts to saying in another form what we have already described, namely that the self-actualized person sees reality more clearly. Our subjects see human nature as it is and not as they would prefer it to be. Their eyes see what is before them without being strained through spectacles of various sorts to distort or shape or color the reality. That was number two. Now, characteristic number three, spontaneity, simplicity, naturalness. Self-actualizing people can all be described as relatively spontaneous in behavior and far more spontaneous than that in their inner life, thoughts, impulses, etc. Their behavior is marked by simplicity and naturalness and by lack of artificiality or straining for effect. This does not necessarily mean consistently unconventional behavior. If we were to take an actual count of the number of times that the self-actualizing person behaved in an unconventional manner, the tally would not be high. His unconventionality is not superficial, but essential or internal. It is his impulses, thoughts, consciousness that are so unusually unconventional, spontaneous, and natural. Apparently, recognizing that the world of people in which he or she lives could not understand or accept this, and since he has no wish to hurt them or to fight with them over every triviality, he will go through the ceremonies and rituals of convention with a good-humored shrug and with the best possible grace. That was number three. Number four, problem-centered. Our subjects are in general strongly focused on problems outside themselves. In current terminology, they are problem-centered rather than ego-centered. They generally are not problems for themselves and are not generally much concerned about themselves, for example, as contrasted with ordinary introspectiveness that one finds in insecure people. These individuals customarily have some mission in life, some task to fulfill, some problem outside themselves, which enlists much of their energies. This is not necessarily a task that they would prefer or choose for themselves. It may be a task that they feel is their responsibility, duty, or obligation. This is why we use the phrase, a task that they must do, rather than the phrase, a task that they want to do. In general, these tasks are non-personal or unselfish, concerned rather with the good of mankind in general, or of a nation in general, or of a few individuals in the subject's family. And I'm just reading a few of the paragraphs, two or three paragraphs from each of the characteristics. The next characteristic, the quality of detachment, the need for privacy. For all my subjects, it is true that they can be solitary without harm to themselves and without discomfort. Furthermore, it is true for almost all that they positively like solitude and privacy to a definitely greater degree than the average person. It is often possible for them to remain above the battle, to remain unruffled, undisturbed by that which produces turmoil in others. They find it easy to be aloof, reserved, and also calm and serene. Thus, it becomes possible for them to take personal misfortunes without reacting violently as the ordinary person does. They seem to be able to retain their dignity even in undignified surroundings and situations. Perhaps this comes in part from their tendency to stick to their own interpretation of a situation rather than to rely upon what other people feel or think about the matter. This reserve may shade over into austerity and remoteness. And the next quality, which is which would be quality number five, is the quality of detachment. No, I just read that one, sorry. Which is autonomy, independence of culture and environment. One of the characteristics of self-actualizing people, he says, which to a certain extent cross-cuts much of what we have already described, is their relative independence of the physical and social environment. Since they are propelled by growth motivation rather than by deficiency motivation, self-actualizing people are not dependent for their main satisfactions on the real world or other people or culture or means to ends or in general on extrinsic satisfactions. Rather, they are dependent for their own development and continued growth on their own potentialities and latent resources. Just as the tree needs sunshine and water and food, so do most people need love, safety, and the other basic need gratifications that can come only from without. But once these external satisfiers are obtained, once these inner deficiencies are satiated by outside satisfiers, the true problem of individual human development begins, i.e. self-actualization. This independence of environment means a relative stability in the face of hard knocks, blows, deprivations, frustrations, and the like. These people can maintain a relative serenity in the midst of circumstances that would drive other people to suicide. They have also been described as self-contained. All right. And the next characteristic is continued freshness of appreciation. Self-actualizing people have the wonderful capacity to appreciate again and again, freshly and naively, the basic goods of life with awe, pleasure, wonder, and even ecstasy, however stale these experiences may have become to others, what C. Wilson has called newness. Thus, for such a person, any sunset may be as beautiful as the first one. Any flower may be of breathtaking loveliness, even after he has seen a million flowers. The thousandth baby he sees is just as miraculous a product as the first one he saw. He or she remains as convinced of his luck in marriage 30 years after his marriage and is as surprised by his wife's beauty or her husband's handsomeness when she is 60 as he was 40 years before. For such people, even the casual workday, moment-to-moment business of living can be thrilling, exciting, and ecstatic. These intense feelings do not come all the time. They come occasionally rather than usually. But at the most unexpected moments, the person may cross the river on the ferry 10 times, and at the 11th crossing have a strong recurrence of the same feelings, reaction of beauty and excitement, as when he rode the ferry for the first time. Beautiful. Now, going on to the next characteristic, and I've lost count. I think we're somewhere around 7 or 8, but I'll try to cover all 16 in this half-hour show if I keep going. The mystic experience, the peak experience, those subjective expressions that have been called the mystic experience and described by William James are a fairly common experience for our subjects, though not for all. The strong emotions described in the previous section sometimes get strong enough, chaotic, and widespread enough to be called mystic experiences. My interest and attention in this subject was first enlisted by several of my subjects who described their sexual orgasms in vaguely familiar terms, which later I remembered had been used by various writers to describe what they called the mystic experience. There were the same feelings of limitless horizons opening up to the vision, the feeling of being simultaneously more powerful and also more helpless than one ever was before, the feeling of great ecstasy and wonder and awe, the loss of placing in time and space, with finally the conviction that something extremely important and valuable had happened, so that the subject is to some extent transformed and strengthened even in his daily life by such experiences. That was the mystic experience. Now, this next characteristic, in the book, he calls it a German word, and it says, I'll try to pronounce it, Gemeinschaftsgefühl. This word, invented by Alfred Adler, is the only one available, he says, that describes well the flavor of the feelings for mankind expressed by self-actualizing subjects. They have, for human beings in general, a deep feeling of identification. They, meaning self-actualizing people, have a deep feeling of identification, sympathy, and affection in spite of the occasional anger, impatience, or disgust described below. Because of this, they have a genuine desire to help the human race. It is as if they were all members of a single family. One's feelings towards his brothers would be, on the whole, affectionate. Even if these brothers were foolish, weak, or even if they were sometimes nasty, they would still be more easily forgiven than strangers. If one's view is not general enough and if it is not spread over a long period of time, then one may not see this feeling of identification with mankind. The self-actualizing person is, after all, very different from other people in thought, impulse, behavior, emotion. When it comes down to it, in certain basic ways, he is like an alien in a strange land. Very few really understand him, however much they may like him. He is often saddened, exasperated, and even enraged by the shortcomings of the average person, and while they are to him ordinarily no more than a nuisance, they sometimes become bitterly bitter tragedy. And the next characteristic, interpersonal relations. Self-actualizing people have deeper and more profound interpersonal relations than other adults, although not necessarily deeper than those of children. They are capable of more fusion, greater love, more perfect identification, more obliteration of the ego boundaries than other people would consider possible. There are, however, certain special characteristics of these relationships. In the first place, it is my observation that the other members of these relationships are likely to be healthier and closer to self-actualization than the average, often much closer. There is high selectiveness here, considering the small portion of such people in the general population. So we'll stop here for this show, and we'll continue in a part two to do a summary of the 16 characteristics of self-actualizing people as indicated by the study done by American psychologist Abraham Maslow, done in the 50s, and I'm reading, and I have been reading from the text, from the book, Personality and Motivation, and there's a chapter in there called Self-Actualizing People, A Study of Psychological Health. And in the beginning, I read a portion of the index, which gave the context for the need to study positive psychology and positive characteristics in people, which is the whole concept of self-actualization, the positive self-growth, the motivation to grow, the continuing striving to grow and become all that we can become. So that's it for now. And what I will do now is go to, I'll complete now, and then we will reconnect later on the second part to continue summarizing the other characteristics that we did not cover today. Thank you for listening. Take care. Bye.